interim's Legislative Audit Committee. The targets are 95% for both 2008 and 2009. What the Commission is proposing to delete are percent of request forms filed within 5 days as a measure, percent of calls responded to within 5 days as a measure, number of presentations each year to judicial meetings, conferences, and other interested groups, including state, public, and private law schools regarding judicial ethics, and percent of complaints received between agendas mailed 10 days before the meeting that are to be reviewed. In addition to these key performance measures, the Legislative Fiscal Office is asking that the Commission do some internal tracking or continue to do some internal tracking of some measures, and they are listed on the last page of the handout. Some of these include percent of investigations leading to prosecutions, percent of judges prosecuted versus total number of judges within the Commission's jurisdiction, the types of complaints, the numbers of complaints, the complaints by type of judge, circuit and pro tem, etc., the recidivism rate of judges who are investigated and charged, the number of judges informally counseled, censured, suspended, removed, acquitted, self-removed, subject to stipulated agreements, or contesting a complaint, percent of stipulated agreements versus total number investigated complaints, and Supreme Court determinations upheld, modified, remanded, or overturned. With that, those are the Commission's proposed measures for 2007 and 2009, Mr. Chair.
All right. Discussion, Senator Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sorry I didn't have the opportunity to ask this question earlier, but could someone explain to me the purpose of the number one percentage of judges who, after being prosecuted by the Commission, are exonerated, and the target is 0%?
Mr. Chair and Senator Brown, what we're looking for there, and perhaps I would ask the Commission Executive Director to come up and assist, but what we're looking for there is to, as a measure of how well the Commission is performing its duties, are the cases that it's pursuing that have been referred to the Commission and are being investigated, are they pursuing those cases appropriately?
Mr. Chair, Senator, as I understand, Mr. Borden and I had gone over these, and he had wanted to move the focus from my timeliness to the Commission's judgment, and it's not worded, I think, in the best possible way, but I think that the point is, are they exercising the best judgment possible in terms of cases that should be dismissed, cases that should go to prosecution, and that sort of thing. It could be reworded to more accurately reflect, are they exercising their judgment appropriately?
Okay.
I mean, I think that exoneration just seemed to be one of those things, you know, was this a prosecution that never should have been brought type of thing. But, you know, if you look at...
Could you please identify yourself?
Oh, I'm sorry. Susan Isaacs, the executive director. I apologize, sir. If you look at 2 and 3, they kind of are... they kind of all three go together because... when you look at, you know, the Commission only makes recommendations to the Supreme Court after holding a hearing. They have no authority to impose discipline. So they will make findings of fact, conclusions of law, and recommendations. So they will say, you know, we find these are the facts that we've found. We find that these particular code provisions have been violated, and we're recommending this sanction. I've seen them also recommend, like, going to Reno to the Judicial College and this type of thing. So that would be one that kind of ties in as well, because it shows that they're exercising their judgment what the Supreme Court does, because as you know, the Supreme Court takes a whole look at it. It's completely de novo review. All the Commission does is make recommendations, and then they will look at the entire record, come up with their own findings of fact, their own code violations, if any, and their own sanction. So That is an example of their exercise of judgment. And then you look down at 3, which is the stipulated agreements. That's a situation where the commission and the judge agree. So, I mean, you do see that there, and I don't know.
Mr. Chair, just a comment. I think the I understand the direction that this benchmark is going towards. I just think it's extremely awkwardly worded, and that, anyway, I just think it's not very well written. No offense to anyone. So.
I appreciate
Thank
that.
You.
We'll keep that in mind perhaps for the next work session.
It could be encompassed in 2 and 3 or eliminated. It's just a judgment measure. And Mr. Borden and I could certainly work on it if you choose, or we could eliminate it, whatever you think would work best.
Well, I think at this point, correct me if I'm wrong, Mr. Borden, we need to move some things through, and maybe next time you come back before the legislature, you can work on revising those with Mr. Borden.
That'd be fine.
Okay.
Thank you. Oh, I'm sorry.
Representative Nathanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Since we're pausing for just a moment on performance measurement, I wanted to make a note about targets and when we report results. In some of these, in almost all of these, the higher the number, the better the situation, like 90%, and then if you made 92%, it would show you did even better than anticipated, you know, if the actual turned out better than the target. Every once in a while, when I see a set of performance measures coming from somewhere, you want the number to be lower. I think it would be easier. It's probably too late. We can't redo every agency's sets of performance measures. But I think it would be easier for the reader if this one, for example, number one, was stated in the inverse. So you're always looking for better numbers, and it's easier to spot where things are getting better or worse. But that's really that's a characteristic of all performance measures, not just this one.
Duly noted. Thank you, Representative Nathanson, and perhaps you can work on those for next time. Ms. Isaacs, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Representative Nathanson.
Yes. Mr. Chair, if it would be appropriate at this point, I'd like to move that the subcommittee adopt the key performance measures and targets as recommended by the Legislative Fiscal Office.
Representative Nathanson moves that the subcommittee adopt the key performance measures and targets as recommended by Legislative Fiscal. Any discussion? Any objections? So moved. And we are done with that budget. And I will close the work session on Senate Bill 551. And I'll open a work session on House Bill 5016, the Council on Court Procedures. Colleagues, there's some issues within this budget, so just to give you a sense that we're not going to move this today, but I will let Mr. Borden suggest to you their findings and recommendation.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. The Council is requesting a budget with a judicial branch recommendation of $115,646 general fund, $8,000 other funds, for a total funds budget of $123,646, two positions and 0.71 FTE. The LFO recommended budget is $10,310 general fund, $8,000 other funds, for a total funds budget of $18,310, zero positions and zero FTE. The Council is requesting a policy package to restore its funding. It is a single policy package for $102,812, comprised of $94,893 for personal services, two positions, 0.71 FTE, and $7,919 for services and supplies. The Legislative Fiscal Office does not recommend approval of this package. The recommendation is based on the findings of the Interim Council on Court Procedures Budget Note Work Group report, of which the LFO office does not concur. At this time, there are no statewide adjustments. If there are any future adjustments, they'll be incorporated into the Council's budget at the end of session omnibus bill. There is one additional technical adjustment, Package 806, which eliminates the state government service charge line item for the Council on Court Procedures in the amount of $2,524. This is a DAS assessment for the department, for the Budget Management Division. And as with past biennia, when the Council's budget has been at a relatively nominal level, those charges have been waived per the direction of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. The Legislative Fiscal Office again recommends a general fund budget of $10,310 and another funds budget of $8,000 for an all funds budget of $18,310. The budget does not include any position or FTE authority. This budget is a $105,336 or 85.2% reduction from the judicial branch's recommended budget and the amount included in the governor's printed budget.
Thank you, Mr. Borden. Does anyone have any questions for Mr. Borden before I... Senator Nelson.
Yes, I don't understand. What was the thing you didn't agree with in that coming out of the report?
Mr. Chair and Senator Nelson, the 2005 legislature anticipated this refunding request from the council. And we anticipate that was anticipated, and a budget note was built into their 2005 budget report for them to establish a work group, evaluate the council role, composition, and membership, and to look at whether it should remain a state agency. The reason why the budget note was originally requested was an attempt to resolve long-standing questions on the part of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means surrounding the substantive basis for the council and its need for general fund. The budget note was also meant to resolve once and for all the council and its need for funding. In the opinion of LFO, the budget note work group provided a little resolution to these underlying issues. I can go on further if you'd like additional information.
I was just wondering what had recalled any of that, so thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Burdick.
So does this mean that the LFO is recommending that it's not an appropriate part of state government?
Mr. Burdick.
Mr. Chair and Senator Burdick, the Legislative Fiscal Office is trying to differentiate the excellent work of the volunteers of the council and the importance of the Oregon Rules of Civil Procedure versus the administrative structure and administrative costs that supports the council.
So what you're saying is you expect these hardworking citizens to work with no administrative support?
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, what the council has done is suggest that the status quo is fine. In prior biennia, they haven't been funded since 2002, so they've gone almost 5 years without state general fund support, except for a $10,000 appropriation that the legislature gave them to undertake the study of their budget note. And so they have been surviving without general fund support. And we asked them to justify why they need additional general fund support, to look at various options of where they could possibly be placed in state government that would be more economical and efficient, as we don't believe they rise to the level of a state agency. The work they do is important, but there is more economical ways to provide that.
And what are some of those ways?
Mr. Chair and Senator.
Hello.
Mr. Chair and Senator Burdick, there were quite a few conversations during the interim on those ways. And there are alternate models of varying degrees. One model is that Oregon is, and to my knowledge, and I may be corrected here, but to my knowledge, Oregon is the only state in the nation that has an independent state agency that does their rules of civil procedure. Almost the majority of other states, this function is a function of the judicial of the Supreme Court, their judicial conference, or some other council associated with directly with the judicial branch of government, the judicial department of government. So there's that option. A second option is, and that option, if would be adopted by Oregon, would require statutory change. Another option would be that a law commission type model. And the law commission would assume these duties and perhaps receive a general fund appropriation similar in the fashion they do with their other functions. Another option would be the legislature resumes the responsibility for the Oregon Rules of Civil Procedure. And a last option is that there could be a combination of agencies, the Council on Court Procedures and perhaps Judicial Fitness could be combined into one agency to get some economies of scale.
And when, colleagues, when I met with Mr. Borden this morning, just so you know, he's been meeting on a regular basis with the council and with that work group around the budget note. And basically, and jump in if you feel like I'm misrepresenting, but he, the intention of the budget note was that they would make the case for reestablishing their funding, and Mr. Borden's view is that that case hasn't been made and that they didn't sufficiently look at other options available. Is that correct?
That's correct, Mr. Chair. If I may, this is not a typical state agency. It meets 3 to 4 hours on Saturdays, once a quarter through the biennium. And granted, they meet in subgroups, and there is additional legal research outside of that. But it just gives you kind of the scope of this agency. It's atypical. And its budget is not sufficient enough it has such a low scale of a budget, it's more efficient to have these duties assumed by or subsumed by another agency or department.
And, colleagues, if I could also mention that you might want to take a look at Pellefo's analysis, page 489, the last couple of paragraphs that outline some of these concerns that Mr. Borden has had. But we're not going to be moving this bill today, but these questions are very germane, and I would encourage you to keep asking for the next couple of minutes, and then we'll have the executive director of the council come up and make some comments as well. Any other questions? Good. Is Professor Peterson in the?
No, looks like.
Or Catherine Clark.
Catherine Clark, a former chair of the council and a official member of the legislative work group.
Ms. Clark, if you would just feel free to make some comments for a couple of minutes, and then we'll come back and do a work session on this next week, most likely, although that is a floating promise.
Representative Shields and members of the committee, we were caught a bit by surprise with this morning. I realize that Mr. Borden has had some feeling about where the work group went as the work group progressed, but the work group report was generated, and these recommendations that he's making here are contrary to the legislative work group. It was a bit, speaking as a member of the work group, it was a bit of a moving target, some of the questions that came from LFO. There were initial questions that we addressed, and then there were further questions, and then at the very end, there were further questions, and some of the members of the work group attempted to start redrafting the report to respond to those and to try to meet them, and the chairs and legislative council said it was just too late to incorporate that information into the work group, and the work group's report went forward. So we have what we have in terms of the work group's analysis. Traditionally in Oregon, historically, the rules have been done by the legislature, not the judicial branch, the rules of procedure for the courts. This has been historical. It would be a change, and a fairly radical change, in the state's policy to move this into the judicial branch. and take the legislature out of the picture. So then the question becomes one of how we're going to accommodate formulating the rules in the most economic way. And one of the things that is overlooked is that if you go, for instance, to the law commission model, there's further involvement of legislative council's time by that model. There's further involvement of the legislature because there has to be affirmative action by the legislature. And we get once more back into the process of hearings that the legislature determined it wanted to avoid when it instituted the council on court procedures. That's certainly true also with resuming the old model, which was to have the legislature do the rules of civil procedure as a regular course of the legislation during the biennial sessions. The council would like to address the questions that Mr. Borden has raised in further detail at an appropriate time. But that's in summary the position that we have. We have attempted to meet the concerns. What I can say is that I'm not sure. I think ultimately I'd suggest that if there is not a resumption of funding in the amount that has been requested and that traditionally the council has been given, I think it's inevitable that the council is going to become inactive, because I'm not sure that we can continue to have volunteer executive director functions, volunteer clerical functions, the functions that Lewis and Clark has taken on without compensation, and that Professor Holland and the University of Oregon did for 2 years without compensation. I don't think we can forever find that sort of support, and without that support, I suggest that the council probably can't function with just solely volunteer members and no support in any way to continue to promulgate the rules. So there would be, by default, an adoption of another model that the work group, after looking at, rejected. I would also say that while the majority have their rules coming out of the judicial branch, almost all of them, including the federal rules of civil procedure, have a process where they're adopted. There's a potential for legislative review or congressional review for the federal rules, and a default adoption if the Congress or the legislature does not act. So while they're centered in the judicial departments of some states, because traditionally rules were generated in the judicial branch, there's still legislative involvement in many states. So I would be happy to answer any questions.
Yeah, I wanted to ask one question. One thing that made sense to me is Mr. Borden's concern that no agency is really overseeing the work of this. I mean, how does, you know, who does oversee the books for this this council if we do decide to fund it?
I believe that since the I'm sorry, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I believe that since the Ms. Gravy was trying to tell me about this, and I can't remember the terminology, since there was the unified court system, adoption of the unified court system, that's when the judicial department overtook sort of the budgetary process, the process of cutting checks for reimbursement for the executive director's salary and the clerical salary. All of that was undertaken and is sort of overseen as just a part of the judicial department's budgetary processes, and they help us with the budget too. And that's an in-kind service that they're providing for us. But in a sense, they've been providing the oversight for that it follows according to the budget.
Representative Dickinson.
Mr. Chair, I hope you'll be patient with a freshman legislator here wondering about the work of the Council on Court Procedures. I feel like I'm hearing a story two-thirds or three-quarters of the way to the end, and I didn't get to see the beginning or understand the background. I have a couple of questions. Is the work of the Council more reactive to problems that have come up, or is it more proactive with regard to changing conditions and environments? And how often are rules changed? The council meets quarterly. Are there changes being reviewed and solutions developed quarterly, or how much work needs to be done how often to take care of business in a timely manner.
Mr. Chair, and Representative Nathanson, perhaps I could speak to your second point and then the agency. Right? The statistics I looked at, which are in our analysis, over the last five biennia, there are, let me preface this, there are about 80 rules or so, approximately. There are 85 rules numerically, but somewhere around 10 less than that, 75 rules that actually have a rule associated with it, and some are placeholders. But over the last five biennia, there have been 34 unique rule amendments or revisions, or approximately 7 rule changes per biennium. And this includes the rule changes promulgated or adopted by the council, as well as changes by the legislature. And of those, about 56% of the time, it was the legislature making changes to the Oregon Rules of Civil Procedure.
Mr. Chair and Representative Nathanson, let me start with the last question as well. I wanted to respond to something that came up when staff was talking about the quarterly meetings. That's not quite accurate. We start our first meeting would occur, for example, for next biennium would occur in December, and then we would meet January. I may not be right about December, even though I've been on the council for 8 years. It's hard for me to remember back. I think it's October. We have our first organizational meeting. We then meet January through June, our regular meetings, and then again in September, and then in December before the legislature comes into session. So it's a bit more than quarterly. We actually work for the entire year. We don't meet every month, but we are working for every month. In terms of the number of rule changes, there are more rules than that considered. And I'd have to say this is answering the first question as well. We are, to a certain extent, reactive in the sense that people come to us with problems or there's voicing of concerns. Certain elements of the bar will say that this particular rule is not functioning appropriately and there's too many squabbles. Sometimes it's the courts that are coming to us, trial court judges, not all of them on the council, who are saying in judicial sometimes at their meetings it surfaces up, bubbles up, that these are problems and we don't want to be dealing with them all the time and can't we formulate a rule to deal with them in a different way. So to some extent it's reactive. Sometimes it's proactive when the Congress enacted HIPAA, the Health Information Protection, I can't remember how it goes. Yeah, Portability Protection Act, whatever it is. When they enacted that, our rules for subpoenaing medical records are totally inconsistent with it, and we had to sit down and revamp the rules. That time we were proactive. We knew about HIPAA, and we knew that we had to take Rule 55 and redo it to comport with HIPAA and import a new language into what seemed to be a perfectly acceptable way of doing business that didn't comply with federal law. So that time we were proactive. So it's a little bit of both, depending on the circumstances. Some of the changes...
Ms. Clark, yeah. I hate to interrupt you, we do have the Attorney General here, and I'm afraid we're going to have to move on to make sure there's enough time for this testimony. But I'm very grateful for you coming down here on such short notice. It's an important issue to us, and we want to make sure that we're doing everything we can to understand the concerns. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So I will close the work session on House Bill 5016, and... if we could please open a public hearing on Senate Bill 5520, Department of Justice Budget, continuing to hear testimony on that. And Mr. Sashan, would you please come forward? Thank you very much for your patience. Sorry. Cut into your time a little bit.
It's okay.
Please proceed when you're ready.
Good afternoon, Chair Shields, members of the committee. I'm Steve Bushong. I'm Chief Trial Counsel for the Oregon Department of Justice, and I'm here to tell you a little bit about the Trial Division. In your materials on page one, you have our mission statement. It has the dubious distinction of being the longest one of the department's mission statements. But we're the defense arm of the state. We are typically representing the state as defendant in lawsuits filed in the state and federal court system. Litigation is an adversarial process. We're the advocates for the state in that process. Our goal is to resolve the cases as efficiently and as favorably to the state's interest as we can, and always attempting to ensure the consistent application of the rule of law. On page 2, I've listed our objectives. Protect the public. We're here to preserve the state's limited resources. We're trying to defend legislative policies that are expressed in laws. Preserve agencies' freedom to exercise their delegated authority. Achieve fair and just results in the public interest. That means sometimes we settle cases, as you'll see in later on in my presentation. And as always, ensuring the consistent application of the rule of law. Our major client agencies, I've listed just a few. Risk Management Division is the state's self-insurance fund. They, of course, cover all state agencies. And I've listed here just a couple of the larger agencies that deal directly with the public just because they are frequently involved in litigation. Department of Transportation is involved in condemnation litigation, where we're litigating over the value of compensation to be paid to landowners. Department of Corrections involved in inmate lawsuits challenging the conditions of confinement. We have a lot of those cases. I've listed the Measure 37 new body of case work, and I'll be addressing that in a moment. And then the Defense of Criminal Convictions, we're doing a separate presentation on that program, so I'm not going to discuss that now. Page 3, I've listed the budget drivers, a few of them, and I guess the point I'd like to make here is it's not just the number of cases that we're involved in, but the type and complexity of the case will also determine the amount of resources that are needed for each case. Measure 37 is a budget driver just because it's a new body of work for us. Employment-related claims, as you'll see later on, we don't get that many lawsuits, but they are a budget driver because they can be expensive to litigate. The liability in those cases often turns on a disputed factual issue. What was the motivation behind a certain employment decision at any time? So those can be expensive to litigate. Claims arising from alleged sexual abuse, we have seen cases like that. Damages are extensive, and again, those often turn on factual issues. I've listed some of the institutional claims. We do get lawsuits involving taking children into protective custody. Either we shouldn't have done it, we should have done it, we should have done it in a different way, we should have placed them in a different foster home, those sorts of cases. The state hospital, we have litigation. We've seen litigation over the conditions at the state hospital, I'm sure you're aware of. Department of Corrections, as I mentioned, the conditions of confinement. I listed condemnation is a budget driver. The Oregon Transportation Improvement Act led to more highway projects. When there are more highway projects, then the state is going to take part of the land adjacent to the highway and pay compensation to the landowners, and there's litigation over the amount of compensation. And then Measure 39 is new. Measure 39, which just passed, essentially prohibits the taking of private property for private purposes. And that's not what makes it a budget driver. What makes it a budget driver for us is that a portion of Measure 39 changes the incentives to negotiate a resolution of a condemnation case, the amount of compensation. Before Measure 39, we would negotiate right up until 30 days before trial, and the final offer that was made 30 days before trial kind of set the bar. And if the compensation awarded by the jury was more than that, then the landowner would get their attorney fees, costs. If the compensation awarded was less, the landowner wouldn't. So there's a built-in incentive to negotiate. Measure 39 changed that. Instead of allowing for negotiation up until trial, the bar is set at the very first offer. So we're anticipating that could lead to more condemnation cases going to trial just because of the built-in incentive. As I said, I'm guessing here because I don't know that will be the case. And at the bottom of page 3, I've listed just the number of cases. And again, it's not just the number of cases that drives our budget, but these are just our case statistics. As you can see, we had a significant upturn in the number of cases starting in 2004. And the number of cases that we defend are pretty much beyond our control. The cases are filed, we're served, and then we go in and defend. We've identified four primary reasons for the increase. First, there was an increase in condemnation cases in 2004-2005. Second, the new Measure 37 cases starting in 2005. Third, there wasn't a blip, an upturn in the number of tort cases in 2004. Those tend to fluctuate over time, so that's not all that surprising. And then fourth, there was an increase in the number of inmate civil right and tort cases that were filed in 2006. The next page, the next slide, will give you the same information but broken down by category. And that, when you look at this slide, it kind of explains what I described as our trends in litigation. The easiest way for me to read this slide is to work from the bottom up. So the numbers that you see in the bottom columns are the number of tort and other tort-related cases that were filed by year. And as you can see, 2004, we did have an upswing up to 259 cases in 2004. And then you see in 2005, the condemnation cases went up to 105. And then we had the addition for the first time in 2005 of the new 22 Measure 37 cases. As you can see, the tort cases went back down to the normal level, but that was offset by the increase in condemnation and Measure 37 cases. And then finally, in 2006, condemnation kind of dropped back down to its expected level. Only 49 cases were opened that year. But then the inmate civil rights cases jumped up. 144 of those cases were filed in 2006. And then we had, again, the additional 101 Measure 37 cases that were opened in 2006 calendar year. So that gives you an idea of how our caseload fluctuates. At the bottom, page 4, the budget drivers, as the number of cases goes up, the complexity of the cases go up, the number of hours billed have risen correspondingly over time, and that's shown at the bottom of page 4. Page 5.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. How many attorneys are in the trial division? I'm trying to look at this piece, but I can't. I mean, it shows total FTE, but how many are attorneys?
Chair Shields, Representative Hannah, I don't have the exact number, but roughly 35 in the trial division, give or take a couple.
Follow-up?
Yes, follow-up. So
what's the normal number of hours that one attorney can bill in a year?
Chair Shields, Representative Hannah, the Department of Justice does have a billed hours expectation of a minimum of 1638 per year. As for those of you who've been in private practice, it's not uncommon for attorneys to bill substantially more than that, 1,800, 2,000 hours per year, for example.
Let's continue.
Sure. On page 5, I've listed how our cases are resolved. This pie chart shows the numbers. As you can see, the biggest percentage of our cases, 45%, are dismissed on a pretrial motion. The second largest category, 40% of our cases are settled prior to trial. 7% we prevail at trial. 6% resolved on summary judgment, and then roughly 2% of the cases that are filed are resolved, and we do not prevail at trial. So that shows how we're doing during that time frame. The pie chart on the bottom of page 5 kind of takes a step back and takes a wider angle view of the work that we do in trial division, and it looks at before a case goes to court, there's a tort claim notice that's filed with Risk Management Division, and these are statistics taken from Risk Management. Of all the tort claims that they receive, 62% of them, they're denied by Risk Management, and the claim goes no further. That's the end of the claim. 29%, the claim is settled by Risk Management, so those cases never come to trial division. They're settled at the outset. And then 6% suit dismissed without payment, 2% suit is settled, 1% the state prevails at trial, and less than 1% the state does not prevail at trial. So that kind of shows the bigger picture, how we fit in there. Moving on, page 6 has our organizational chart. We have the division administration. That's me. The number of positions listed there includes all the receptionists, investigators, all of the support staff that serve the trial division. And then our four units are shown in our organizational chart. And the positions listed here are the attorney and paralegal positions. And those are the numbers from the governor's recommended budget. I should say the four units, this is how we're currently organized, but we do retain the flexibility to shift positions among the units depending on our workload. That does happen on occasion. At the bottom of page 6, and then continuing on to page 7, I've listed the four main areas of our programs. Again, I wanted to reiterate that the number of cases don't tell the whole story. These aren't cookie-cutter cases by any means. You need to look at the type and complexity of the cases, and there's a wide variety of them. Our first program, Defense of Criminal Conviction, you'll hear about later, so I'm not going to discuss right now. But second, the Defense of Civil Litigation, which is primarily what we do. Civil rights, tort, employment claims, a wide variety of those. Contracts, commercial, administrative claims. Administrative claims are review of agency orders in other than contested cases. Those cases are filed in the circuit courts, and we're handling those. Natural resources, environmental, Measure 37 claims. Constitutional challenges to state laws and programs. We litigate in the state and federal courts. Over on page 7, the initiation of condemnation litigation. As I said, this involves the taking of private property for a public purpose, typically a highway project. And we coordinate these projects with the Department of Transportation. And the issue in dispute that's actually litigated is the amount of just compensation that will be paid to the landowner. And then the last category, initiation of civil litigation in special cases. We do occasionally serve as representing the state as plaintiff in a lawsuit. Occasionally those cases involve sovereignty or federalism issues, the allocation of power between state and federal government. An example of that would be the case that Oregon filed against the United States Attorney General over his effort to block the Oregon Death with Dignity Act, litigated that case up to the United States Supreme Court, and Oregon prevailed, I'm happy to report. And then the second, the Attorney General is notified whenever the constitutionality of a law is challenged in court, even if the state is not a party to the litigation. And then we have to make a decision. Are we going to intervene in that lawsuit to defend the statute? Are we going to file an amicus brief? Sometimes the parties are situated to defend it themselves, so we don't take any action, but we do get involved in those kind of cases. At the bottom of page 7, I've listed a few of the major significant cases that just occurred to me off the top of my head as I put this together. The last biennium, the Anstett case was a class action lawsuit involving the medical treatment provided to inmates with hepatitis C, and there are hundreds of them. And we were involved in a class action lawsuit that was resolved through a mediated settlement in which the Department of Corrections changed its treatment protocols. There have been some follow-up lawsuits on individual cases regarding the application of those protocols, but the major case has been resolved. I listed the challenge to the adequacy of funding that came up last session. The state prevailed at the trial court level. That case is now pending on appeal. Harmon versus Fickle was another class action lawsuit challenging the overcrowded conditions at the state hospital. That case was resolved partly through some additional funding provided by the emergency board to the Department of Human Services. Young versus Oregon, I listed. That's has come up before, and it is not completely resolved yet because of a recent Supreme Court ruling that's required a recalculation of overtime payments to certain class members. And then the last one I listed is an example of the sexual abuse cases that we have seen. We've actually received nine plaintiffs have sued over sexual abuse by a former counselor for the Oregon Youth Authority named Michael Boyles, who was prosecuted for that activity. Moving on to page 8, this is just the pie chart that you have on the blow-up as well, and you see where trial fits in. We are 6% of the total expenditures of the department, 7% by FTE. At the bottom, you see our budget history. It has gone up, and in the most recent the governor's recommended budget, it reflects primarily two things: the Defense of Criminal Conviction Program, which you'll hear about later, and then the additional resources for Measure 37 litigation, which I'll mention in a moment. And on page 9, the two performance measures, the two key performance measures that apply to the trial division, first, the percentage of legal cases in which the state's position is upheld. The target set for the entire Department of Justice, 92%, we're well above that and have been for several years. The data that you see there is for the trial division only. And then the second key performance measure is the percentage of appropriate litigation that's resolved through settlement. Again, the target of 32% is for the department as a whole, and the data that you see are the numbers for the trial division. As again, you can see we're doing quite well above the target in that category as well.
Can I ask you a question? The corrections litigation unit is within this one, is that correct?
Chair Shields, the corrections litigation is included in the key performance measure 137-1, in which our position is upheld. It is not included in the settlement numbers, performance measure 137-2, because it's very difficult to resolve those cases. That's the defense of the criminal conviction. The inmate litigation that involves the conditions of confinement are reflected in both numbers.
Right. And I was just wondering if you had, you know, I saw that the number of complaints has increased. I'm sure part of that has to do with just an increase in inmates. But have you seen any trends over the last 10 years in inmate litigation, them happening in one particular area over the others?
Chair Shields, the trend that we have seen deals primarily with the medical treatment area. We've seen a lot of litigation involving claims that the medical care provided to inmate is inadequate contrary to the constitutional standards. I think aside from that, I don't think we've been able to identify any other trends.
Senator Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a comment. I think your key performance measure 137-1, you clearly are exceeding the performance measure, and I think that's fabulous. I don't know anybody who has that kind of statistics. I just would say it's probably time to revise the performance measure since you're already meeting that one, so exceeding it. So congratulations. That's really impressive.
Thank you.
Please continue.
Moving on to page 10, the major budgetary issues that we've addressed, aside from the Department of Criminal Convictions Program, Measure 37, which I'll discuss in a moment, and then the other two are they're accounting. They're no new positions involved. These are accounting changes that I understand our Administrative Services Division will address, so I'm not going to mention those further. Policy Option Package 150 is the Measure 37 Policy Option Package. Mr. Arnold spoke to that last week. We are involved in litigation, primarily from two types of litigation arising from Measure 37. A claimant who is unsatisfied with the relief that's been granted by a state agency will file suit seeking either compensation or further relief. We also see litigation by neighbors of Measure 37 claimants who are contending that relief should not have been granted. So we get it from both directions, and that's what Policy Option Package 150 is designed to address. It does include, it continues the emergency board authorization for three attorneys, one paralegal, a legal secretary, and an office specialist. And those were the needs we projected at the time of the emergency board. It does not include, as it's shown on page 11, resources needed for the legal review of whatever portion of the 3,500 claims that lead to litigation. Those claims were filed in early December and late November of 2006. And it also does not provide resources for the defense of anticipated litigation from those claims or take into account any potential legislative action, which I understand is a very hot topic at the legislature. So at this point, we're not recommending, we're recommending that action be delayed on this policy option package. And I realize I did go very quickly. I apologize for that. That is the end of my presentation. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Looks like you have one.
I'm sorry. The key performance measure that Senator Brown mentioned, 137-1, the 92% target is for the department as a whole, not just for trial division.
Oh, okay.
And so our numbers are above, but I think if you factor in all of the divisions, that I think we're happy with the 92% as a target.
All right. Thank you very much for that testimony. Before you got us back on track pretty much with our time. Questions, anyone? Mr. Bushon, thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Next up, Ms. Williams, welcome to the committee. And just so everyone knows, we may need a little more detail into the defense of criminal convictions. This has been discussed with the Attorney General, and we might dive into that tomorrow, depending on how far we get. So, Ms. Williams, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Shields, members of the committee. I'm Mary Williams. I'm the Solicitor General, and I'm in charge of the Appellate Division. I'm going to touch very lightly on a description of the Appellate Division because the key challenge for appellate has been the defense of criminal convictions, and I want to leave enough time that we're able to go into some detail on that. I think we'll be able to get started on it. We'll see how far we get on it. The appellate...
Members of the Subcommittee, Mr. Chair, just real briefly. The defense of criminal convictions is the largest increase in their budget in terms of... And it is very complex on why this is increasing, so I don't... If you don't hurry it through right. That, because you need to understand that the Subcommittee does.
Yes.
Thank you, Ms. Wilson.
All right, so we'll start with the Appellate Division. I will go fairly quickly through this. Beginning on page one of the slides for the Appellate Division is the Appellate Division mission, which is to represent the state's interest in the appellate courts, both state and federal appellate courts. And that actually has two prongs to it. One is to win cases, but the second and sometimes the more important mission is to shape the law that comes out of the appellate courts so that it best reflects the state's interest and the legislature's intent. Turning to page two for the Appellate Division, primarily what the revenue is comes from charging for services. I have to be honest, I don't know what the little tiny slice is that says other revenues. We're looking into what that is. So, the organization of the Appellate Division, unlike the other divisions that you'll hear about for the Department of Justice, we don't have formal units. What we have are attorneys. Our FTE for attorneys is actually on page 9 of the appellate slides. We have a total of 36.76 FTE for attorneys, 7 attorney managers, and then the remainder of our FTE are support staff. Those attorneys and staff are there to do anything that comes in the door, no matter what kind of case it is. So our organization is that we have managers who are in charge of different kinds of cases. Those managers then do the intake on the cases. They write a short summary for each case, and we assign them out to the attorneys in the division. That gives us maximum flexibility for moving the workload around as we need it to be able to respond to changes in the appeals coming in. The largest change in our FTE for appellate is the changes that would be a part of the Defense of Criminal Convictions mandated caseload package 040, and we'll be talking about that when we talk about Defense of Criminal Convictions. The page 3 shows how the appellate piece fits into the overall Department of Justice budget in terms of expenditures and FTE. And the bottom slide there shows our budget history. The one thing I want to point out in terms of the budget history is that those changes are primarily changes that are because of increases in the hourly rate for the Department of Justice attorneys. We've not had new positions that are reflected, significant changes in the new positions from 1999 until what we're now asking for as far as new positions. So the changes in the budget are primarily simply changes in our hourly cost. Turning to page 4 and the budget drivers for the appellate division, we're primarily reactive. We respond to cases that someone else files in the appellate courts. And so 95% of our cases, we're the respondent. In only 5% of our cases, are we making the decision to take an action to the appellate court. If the state doesn't react in these cases, and especially where we're the respondent in the case, there are concerns, obviously, for public safety, where a lot of these cases, a large amount of the cases that we do, are in the criminal area. There's an issue in terms of money being wasted. If we're not able to respond to defend what a court has done or what an agency has done, it may mean that a case is going to be remanded, and then additional costs are going to accrue for the state as things have to be done over again if we're not able to successfully defend the cases in the appellate courts. Another cost issue is that if we're not doing our job properly, it's not a job that simply goes away. And so if we're not doing the work in terms of identifying the state's legal interest and advocating for the state, then much of that work simply shifts to the appellate courts, and they have to do what otherwise we need to be doing as part of our job. Without us, again, the announced law may not reflect the state's interest and may not reflect what the legislature intends, especially when we're dealing with cases that involve the meaning of statutes. The slide at the bottom of page 4 and the one at the top of page 5, they describe many of the efforts that we've made over the past several years to bring down our legal costs. And when we are talking with the Defense of Criminal Convictions, I have a slide that shows that we've been very successful in bringing down the cost per case, not only for the criminal cases, but also for our civil and administrative cases as well. And primarily what we're focusing on are ways to improve communication with the attorneys in the division, between managers and the attorneys, to try to do things to reduce duplication of efforts. So we try to find ways to specialize and have people who are handling similar issues really become the experts in those areas, and they're able to be much more efficient in doing that work. The slide at the top of page 5, just a couple of those that I want to mention. Waiver of appearance is something that we use primarily in the non-criminal cases. It's not something we like to do in the criminal cases, and I'll talk about that more when we get to that discussion. But an example of where we would waive appearance would be an unemployment case where both the employer and the employee are well represented in the case, and that the issues that they're litigating have nothing to do with an employment department rule or a statute. And so if they're able to actually present the issues to the appellate court in consultation with the employment department, we may decide that the state really has no interest that needs to be represented in that case, and will simply waive appearance. So it's not something that we do very often, but there are times when the state really doesn't need to be involved in the appellate case. Motion practice is a way that we're able to resolve cases more quickly than the traditional briefing that I'll describe that we normally do, by asking the courts to maybe summarily affirm or reverse a decision. And so it's something that we're able to use to kind of short-circuit the normal process and to move cases through more quickly. One of the ones I also wanted to mention was the motion to dismiss for inmates who abscond. One of the rules that the Court of Appeals has, and the Supreme Court, although we use this primarily in the Court of Appeals, is that if there is a case involving an inmate and the inmate is not cooperating with supervision, so primarily these are individuals who are on parole or probation or under post-prison supervision, if they're not meeting with their parole officer and they're not doing what they should be doing, if there's a warrant out for them, we're able to ask the Court of Appeals to simply dismiss any appeals that they have pending, and the court will do that. So If you're not cooperating with the system, you don't get to pursue your appeal. And we actually dismiss about 50 cases a year because of this provision. And so the time we spend checking on the status of these individuals is time that allows us to generate some savings by eliminating cases that otherwise we would have to brief and argue in the appellate courts. The designation of lead cases for issues that repeat is primarily in the defense of criminal convictions area, and I'll talk more about that when we go through that review. In terms of the work of the division, we are a very active participant in the state appellate courts. In the Court of Appeals, we're a party in about 80% of the cases that the court sees. We don't do a lot of domestic relations, and there are some other areas that we don't touch on, but most of what the Court of Appeals handles, we're involved in the case. In the Oregon Supreme Court, we're in about 50 to 60% of their cases. I think if I were to look at that number for the past year, it's probably gone down a bit as we've cut back on some of our discretionary appeals to the Supreme Court in the criminal area, trying to conserve resources. In the federal appellate courts, we appear in the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. We're a small player for the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. And very rarely we appear in the United States Supreme Court. As Mr. Bushong mentioned, we had a success in the United States Supreme Court with the Death with Dignity Challenge. But actually we did better than that. For the court's last term, which runs from October through the summer, Oregon had three cases before the United States Supreme Court, which is a very high number for a state the size of Oregon, and Oregon won three cases in the United States Supreme Court. So, turning to page six, the budget drivers, much of our work comes from district attorney's offices. Those are the criminal cases, and those are funded through the general fund, and we'll talk about that in much more detail in the next piece of this. We also have cases coming from other Department of Justice divisions, such as trial, general counsel, civil enforcement. So cases that have been through the trial courts or where general counsel has worked with an agency to issue an order or do a contested case hearing. And those are funded primarily through direct billings to the agency or through risk. And so that covers actually those next two pieces. We also have some cases that are simply legislatively mandated. Primarily, that's our ballot title work. We will draft and defend ballot titles. Ballot titles are actually funded. It's a general fund program, and it's actually funded through the Defense of Criminal Convictions program. That's sort of where the money ends up for us managing it. But we try to keep it separate that the ballot titles and the criminal work are not the same thing. In terms of our types of cases, there are the four basic categories. I'm not going to talk in detail about defense of criminal convictions at this point. I will say, though, that historically, defense of criminal convictions has been about two-thirds of the appellate caseload, with everything else about a third. Over for the current biennium, that's probably more like 50-50. And as we're looking forward into next biennium, I would expect that the defense of criminal convictions may be even greater than the two-thirds as we try to catch up with work that we haven't been doing this biennium. On page 7, there are slides that give some examples of the types of cases for both the civil and the administrative. The only explanation I want to give on the civil cases is for the state habeas corpus cases. Those are typically challenges to conditions of confinement brought by inmates, challenging things about the institution or about things that are going on within institutions. For the administrative cases, the agency cases that we have, I've listed some examples here. Often they involve professional licenses. Regulatory decisions, benefits decisions are sort of the three main categories of agency cases that we'll see. But anything an agency can do, either as a contested case or in other than a contested case, that is subject to review is likely to find its way into the appellate courts. Turning to page 8, we have kind of a mix of some other kinds of cases. Occasionally the legislature will direct that an issue be reviewed. Primarily, they will send it directly to the Oregon Supreme Court for review. So some examples there are prison siting cases, redistricting decisions that occur every 10 years. And so we'll represent the state in those original jurisdiction cases. Mandamus cases are when someone wants to direct an official to do something, and often these are cases that are filed trying to have the appellate court direct a trial judge or a state official to take a particular action, and will represent the state in those. Ballot titles, again, I've already mentioned. Amicus is a term that means friend of the court, and it is when the state is not a party in an appeal, but the state does have an interest in the appeal. So there may be the meaning of a statute may be at issue, constitutional provision may be at issue. And so even though we're not actually a party in the litigation, we'll appear to set forth the state's legal position as far as the meaning of the statute and how the court ought to resolve the case. Sometimes those are in the Oregon Supreme Court. Rarely they're in the Oregon Court of Appeals. This term we have filed three amicus briefs in the United States Supreme Court, one in the punitive damages case that's listed there, and also in a lumber case arising coming out of Oregon, and a fair credit case. Now moving on to the nuts and bolts of what we actually do in the appellate division, the chart at the bottom of page 8 kind of walks through the steps that we follow with most of our cases. As I said, we're 95% reactive, so most of the time what happens is someone is unhappy with a decision made in a trial court or by an agency. They file a notice of appeal or a petition for judicial review. A record is prepared. The person who is unhappy will file an opening brief that sets out what they think is wrong with the decision. And at that point, the case comes to us, and we will assign it to an attorney who reviews the record, does the legal research, prepares a brief that responds to the legal issues that the appellant has presented. There's an oral argument. It's a very short, polite argument in the appellate court. We wait for a court decision. And then depending on the outcome of the court decision, if we lose a case, we review that to decide whether to petition for reconsideration if we're in the Court of Appeals and we think that maybe they've simply missed something, or to ask the Supreme Court to review the case. If the Supreme Court decides to review a case, then you essentially start the cycle over again with additional briefing, additional argument, and then again waiting for a court decision. So most of our work is handled by attorneys. We're very primarily that's what we have in the division, are attorneys who are briefing and researching these issues and preparing briefs, doing oral argument. The top of page 9 shows the FTE, and the thing I would point to in that slide is that currently our average workload per attorney is 60 to 70 cases briefed per year. And every time I've either done this presentation or prepared the materials for this presentation before, that figure has been 40 to 50 cases per year. And that increase has been largely driven by the problems that we faced in the defense of criminal convictions and how we've tried to respond to the resource needs in that area. The final slide shows... Yes,
Chair. I could ask a question. Yes. For those of us who aren't lawyers, could you describe the difference between cases assigned and cases briefed?
Yes, Chair Shields. When we count cases in a couple of ways when we're trying to simply sort of track information about the division, we count the cases when we assign them out to an attorney. That attorney may decide that there's a way to resolve the case without actually briefing the case. And so maybe filing a motion, maybe asking the court to dismiss it if we find out that the person is no longer in the system or cooperating with the system. There may be a few other things that will happen that will allow us to actually move a case off of an attorney's desk without actually having that person file a brief. So when we're looking at our statistics, there are some measures that we look at based on the number of cases coming in the door, how many cases we're assigning out. There are others that are related to how many cases are we actually briefing. And so the cases briefed are those where a brief is filed and the case is actually argued in the appellate court.
Great. Thank you very much.
Sure, just
Senator Brown.
Follow up. Do your attorneys that actually write the briefs, are they also the ones responsible for doing the oral arguments, or is that sort of responsibility charged to someone else? Or
Chair Shields, Senator Brown, for the most part, the attorney who prepares the brief will do the oral argument, and occasionally our attorneys will argue off of someone else's brief, and usually that's simply so that we're able to kind of keep things moving, and if someone is not available, we don't like to ask the appellate court to reschedule arguments for us. And so, in fact, last week I had to ask two people to argue three of my cases because I was preparing my budget notes. So so it does happen. It's that if we lose those, I'm sure it's my briefs and not their arguments.
Representative Hanna.
Thank you, Chair Shields. Of the 19 new positions, how many then are attorneys?
Chair Shields and Representative Hanna, I will break that out in detail if with the defense of criminal convictions, because they're all related to the defense of criminal convictions. But those are, I can tell you that of the 19 positions, 12.75 are either attorneys or attorney managers. We also have a paralegal, two legal secretaries, and two office specialists.
Follow up. Will that bring your workload back down to the 40 to 50? Do you know what it does? Or
Chair Shields, Representative Hanna, no. I don't expect that we're going to go back down to 40 to 50, although I do expect that as we hire new attorneys, there is a learning curve as they gain experience and are able to be as productive as the attorneys who we have, who have been producing at such an incredible rate over the current biennium. So my guess would be that we'll see that number come back down some. I'm hoping that we can keep it above the 40 to 50 that we've seen in the past. That actually is the end of the very quick run-through for the appellate division, unless there are other questions about just sort of the basics of what we do for the division.
No other questions. Should we give it a run or just
well,
return
we
early?
Well, we have 5 minutes. Is it worth starting the next section, or would it be best to start a new and fresh tomorrow?
I think that's probably would be the better approach.
That would be great. Thank you very much, Ms. Williams, for your testimony, and I apologize that we got cut into your time a little bit. We'll do our best not to let that happen again.
Okay. Thank you.
All right, tomorrow, DOJ, all day.
All day.
And
hopefully no interruptions. On Thursday is parole board's work session, as well as the public testimony for Department of Justice. So if there are any folks that have called and want to testify, Thursday is the day for it, if you'd like to tell them that, or they can call our office. And but please remind them that if they want to testify, everything's done in order of sign-ups, unless there's, is it 100 miles or whatever the magic number is, I can't remember.
Okay. All right. Anything else? We will close this.